For the week of May 2nd, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 52, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
In Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And outside the chill spot in Nashville, Tennessee, where the floodwaters are slowly receding, I'm Michael Giltz.
Was there a flood in Nashville?
Have you not looked at the paper in the last 2 days?
Yeah, are you not watching TV?
It's the worst flood in Nashville history. I should say it's the worst rain they've had. The record before was 6.6 inches in a 24-hour period. We've had 13 to 15 inches. I was helping my friends relocate to Nashville, and our possessions were floating down the street. Had two inches of water in the bedroom and in the living room. Had to move all the boxes upstairs. The highways were shut down. The Coast Guard was brought in. Nashville, by the way, is landlocked, but the Coast Guard was brought in to help rescue people. And a dozen people have died. It's declared a state of emergency. It's unbelievable. I've had 2 weeks that make me want to rename myself Job.
Well, the funny thing is I just saw A Serious Man, which of course is the Coen Brothers.
I'm right on top of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I had my hard drive crash 10 days after the warranty expired, and I've been on the road for 2 weeks. So I lost about 800 emails. My tenants in New York took a runner 4 months behind on the rent. Thank you, writer Thorn Keith Hillsbury and David Sheehan, who is an animation student in New York City, and Thorn Keith Hillsbury, a published author, and now deadbeat. And
yikes.
On a serious note, my friend's wife's father, extremely ill, went right from the hospital to hospice. You know, it's just a matter of days or weeks. And then the house flooded in Nashville, Tennessee, that they just purchased, that I was helping them move into. And literally, flood waters were rising all weekend long. It was unbelievable.
Well, at the end of this week, hopefully you are headed to a better place.
I will be rummaging through my soaking clothes and packing up to head to Cannes and London. So that'll be exciting. Yes, Cannes starts a week from Wednesday.
Right. And actually, we should say a little programming note up front here. Next week's episode, we probably cannot record on a Monday since, Michael, you'll be traveling and I will be traveling and just arriving in Cannes. So
it'll just be me by myself?
Yeah, just talk to yourself.
About entertainment.
Well, maybe we can do it on Tuesday. I don't know. And Michael, we have to figure out what we're going to do, whether we're going to do daily updates or updates once or twice during the festival. We'll figure it out once we get there, though.
I think we should do our weekly one. And if we want to do one or two in the middle there, why not?
Right. Right now, you're seeing the sausage get made, ladies and gentlemen.
Did this week's podcast go up yet? I didn't see it.
It went up on Sunday. I was having lots of connectivity problems.
Oh, sorry to hear it. I was fighting back floodwaters and rescuing puppies from trees in Nashville, so I don't want to hear about it.
Wow, I was at my 20th high school reunion.
Oh, how did that go?
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I can honestly say I could not have, plotted it out better.
How so?
You know how you dream of coming back to your high school reunion and you look great and you have a cool job?
I have Neil Patrick Harris on my arm.
Exactly. No, I wore this single thing very proud, especially since almost every single woman there that I've gone to high school with is married with kids. And they all looked they all looked good, but they all look kind of tired.
Well, the women always look better than the men, right? The men look pretty thick, a little thicker.
Men are a little thicker and a little balder. But, I mean, for the most part, people don't change. They look the same. They act the same. It's essentially like having the exact same conversation that you had with these people 20 years ago, but the topics are a little bit more updated.
Well, and at this point during the show, I'm sure there are people out there who are saying, isn't this an entertainment news podcast? And yes, it is, and we will get to some entertainment news. But overall, Karen, you had a good time?
I had a great time, and I totally pushed the podcast, and so I really can't say anything bad about anybody who was there.
Was there anybody cute that you'd always liked that you saw there?
Yeah, he was there, married.
Happily?
Yeah, actually, and his wife is really very sweet, so it's kind of a bummer.
So it's all good.
Well, we've definitely got a lot of news to cover this week. We're going to be talking, of course, as always, about box office first, and we'll hand it over to Michael in just a moment. We're going to be talking a lot about, of course, Iron Man is opening this weekend, and we have a little Sandra Bullock news, which if you haven't heard by now, then welcome to Earth. We're going to be talking a lot about television shows, especially those shows which are on the bubble. We've talked about them before, but now it's getting down to the wire. And we'll even be reading some listener email later in the show. Of course, you can always email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address to send your emails off to. Or you can call us. 1-888-567-SAND is the number. But before we get to any of that, Michael, why don't you tell us what happened, at least in North America, over the weekend at the box office?
Absolutely. While Karen was at her high school reunion and I was bailing out water to stay alive, A Nightmare on Elm Street grossed $32.2 million. It's a huge opening. It may be is it the record for Nightmare on Elm Street? I'm not sure, but I know it's grossed more than the entire run of the first, second, fifth, and seventh entries in the Nightmare series. So that's a massively successful launch for yet another no-name horror film. At number two was How to Train Your Dragon, which grossed more than $10 million for the sixth weekend in a row. It's at $192 million in the U.S. and $386 million worldwide. At number three was Date Night with Steve Carell and Tina Fey. They've made $73 million total in the U.S. Number four is The Backup Plan, which I cannot remember what it is. And it's falling quickly. Whatever it is, it's made $7.2 million. It's at $22 million total.
Wait, you mean the movie?
I can't remember what The Backup Plan is.
It's the one with
J-Lo.
Yeah.
Oh, right. That's right. That's where she gets pregnant before she meets the man she loves and gets married. That's right.
Right, yeah.
And at number five is Brendan Fraser in another family franchise movie called Furry Vengeance, which really gave me the heebie-jeebies. Just the trailer looks so god-awful. But I had a friend who said it wasn't that bad, but apparently he's fairly alone in that. It grossed $6.5 million for a very weak opening at number five with a 2,000 per screen average. So I'm sorry, Aaron, if you're listening, you're fairly alone on Furry Vengeance. But I will watch it on DVD when it comes out. And then 6 through 10 are holdovers like The Losers, which is a ripoff of The A-Team, which is falling fast, grossed $6 million. Clash of the Titans, which is at $154 million in the U.S. and $406 million worldwide. So it's still ahead of its nemesis, How to Train Your Dragon. Number 8 was Kick-Ass, which still, you know, it's at $42 million and it costs $30 million to make. And at number 9, Death at a Funeral. Number 10, Oceans, which is a nature film from Disney, which dropped hard. It's grossed $13 million total. It only made $2.6 million this weekend. It costs $80 million to make. So it's going to have to make a lot of money overseas to overcome that deficit.
You know, you might watch Furry Vengeance on DVD, but just the posters alone have turned me off. I really wish someone would tell Brendan Fraser to stop making family films and just leave it at George of the Jungle and Encino Man.
I think it looks sort of funny. I, you know what? All I've seen though is the print ads, and I know the concept. So that's it. It's not something I would see, but I think it looks sort of, you know, warped, which really goes with my sense of humor. So,
warped. Yeah, I was planning to take the kids this weekend. My friend's kids. We were going to go. The little girl Laurel loves animals. She wants to be a large animal vet. So Furry Vengeance sounded right up her alley. You see animals, you know, telling the developer, "Don't build over our wooded area." And they get the revenge on Brendan Fraser. I mean, I like Brendan Fraser a lot. He's likable. He's made a lot of family films like Journey to the Center of the Earth and George of the Jungle. I could never understand why they didn't make a sequel to that. They took years and they made a direct-to-DVD sequel that didn't include Brendan Fraser. He was great in that. It was perfect for a sequel. I don't know why he didn't make one to that. But I wish he'd make more adult films as well, if anything else. But
and by adult films, we should preface.
You mean not porn.
Actually, I wish he would make an adult film, now that you mentioned it. But I also would like him to make films for adults that are more intelligent and not just geared towards the kiddie set.
Well, what do you want to do about next weekend? Because should we do an over-under? Should we take bets on how much money Iron Man 2 is going to make? I mean, it's obviously going
to
be in first place.
What did it open to? What did it open to in its original debut?
I have no idea. But it did open this past weekend in Europe and in several foreign countries. It made $100.2 million, which is 26% more than the original Iron Man opened to in the same 53 foreign markets in 2008.
Well, that's how a sequel should behave, right?
One would hope, yes.
One would hope, but this isn't getting very good reviews, so that's not going to help it. It's probably not going to hurt it. I'd say it's about 100.
Yeah, I would say about 100, 110, maybe 115.
Iron Man grossed $102 million in its opening weekend on May 2nd, my birthday, in 2008. So as a sequel, you know, it should do even better. So I'm gonna say 120 million.
Well, you know, it's forecast to do about $140 million in North America. So, of course, anything under that will then be a disappointment, which is a shame because making $100 million in a weekend is actually pretty darn good.
Yeah, we shouldn't know. I mean, if it grosses over $100 million, it'll be one of the biggest openings of all time. So anyone to call anything over $100 million a disappointment is just nutty. That's just not, you know, I don't care what you predict. If it makes $100 million, you know, it's a success. And, you know, that's this is what we did last weekend with Kick-Ass, where we said, oh, they had crazily high predictions. And when it didn't match them, they said, oh, it's a disaster. It was like, you know what? It costs $30 million to make. It's making $48 million, so... leave it alone. That's actually a success.
There's a great story in the Wall Street Journal today about how Disney is kind of slowly tightening its grip over the Iron Man franchise and over a lot of the Marvel franchises. Of course, Disney purchased Marvel, the comic book company, last year for, I think, $4.3 billion. And they are going to reap the rewards by getting most of the money from Iron Man 2. Paramount is only going to get 8% as a distribution and marketing fee.
Whew.
And, you know, they go into how Paramount couldn't hold the world premiere in London because of the Icelandic volcano, and how Disney stepped up, and how Robert Iger was walking up and down the red carpet and made himself known at the red carpet.
Yeah, I was confused. Since Paramount was going to hold it in London, why didn't they hold the relaunch in North America? Why did Disney step in for the U.S. launch?
Well, the world premiere was supposed to be in London, but in the end, the world premiere was, I believe, here in Los Angeles.
Right. So the world premiere that Paramount was going to do.
Yes.
I don't understand why, since they couldn't do it in London, why suddenly Disney got to hold it instead of Paramount.
Well, Paramount still held it. I think Disney just stepped in and helped out with a few of the details.
It's going to be a long, long time before Disney gets their hands on a lot of the Marvel characters. I mean, Universal has, you know, Spider-Man roller coaster rides. I mean, it's going to be decades before they actually get to populate their park with a lot of these characters, right?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because that is what the Wall Street Journal says. They're pointing out that even though Robert Iger, the CEO of Disney, is talking about moving some of the Marvel characters into the Disney theme parks, either through smaller attractions or characters that walk through the park, and then eventually some big rides like Pirates of the Caribbean, that unfortunately for him and unfortunately for Disney, the company is somewhat constrained by agreements previously struck by Marvel when they were on their own. And as you mentioned, they granted Universal Studios Florida the exclusive right in that region to create rides based on many of its major characters, including, by the way, Iron Man.
Karen, are you excited about the movie? Will you go see it?
I won't go see it opening weekend, but I do plan on seeing it.
See, I feel like it's only fun to go opening weekend, especially if you hear it's getting bad reviews, you know. Once people have seen it and said it's bad, then going to me is sort of tiresome. I'd rather go open and go, yeah, it's bad, but I saw it first.
Yeah, but then I usually don't go to opening weekend movies because I don't like being around people in the crowds. I hate people, remember?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there was an interesting article on Cinematical about whether the audience, or lack thereof, makes a movie better or worse. And
absolutely, it always better.
Makes it better.
All right, so...
yeah.
That's why they always like to have test screenings, especially with comedies, with a crowd.
Right.
And that's why they shouldn't open movies so wide and keep them wide so much, because there's a lot to be said for having a three-quarter full theater rather than a half-full theater. You know, mm-hmm. It makes for a much better experience. But, you know, Iron Man 2, I remember when Iron Man 1 came out and the studio was like, oh, we're going to do Iron Man 2. And both, you know, Jon Favreau and Robert Downey Jr. will hold on. We want to do it right. We made this movie right. We want to take our care with the sequel. We don't want to rush it. And I feel like they were rushed, you know?
Oh, I mean, no, they weren't. Years. How could they possibly have been rushed?
It was only 2 years.
It's 2 years. That's not long. It wasn't, you know, the movie came out in May of 2008. And the studio was immediately like, we want a sequel. And now it's already out. It's 2 years. It's not, they didn't take, I don't think they took their time and made their, you know, all the reviews are poor so far. And all of them say it's sort of a mess and doesn't have the charm of the original. That's a shame, because I like Robert Downey Jr. a lot and was hoping they'd be able to pull off the trick.
Well, I guess we should move on. And this next story is an unfortunate one. Actress Lynn Redgrave died at the age of 67 Sunday evening, and we record on Mondays, so she died last night. Of course, she is the aunt of Natasha Richardson, who died in a skiing accident last year, and the sister of Vanessa Redgrave. She was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, one in 1966 for her role in Georgie Girl, and in 1998 for Gods and Monsters.
Yeah, I was sad when I saw this. The Redgraves are not having a good few years.
Well, yeah, and she was suffering from cancer
Breast cancer.
Yeah, for the last 7 years. So this is a long battle with breast cancer, which she ultimately succumbed to. So
she's always been sort of interesting because she's always seemed sort of like the lesser Redgrave, if I can rudely say that. You know, she sort of seemed, you know, Lynn Redgrave. She sort of was jokey and not didn't seem as have as much depth as her siblings and relatives and the Redgrave family. But over the years, she started to do, especially in theater work, she did Shakespeare for My Father, which she wrote and starred in his solo show about her dad, who was a closeted gay man. And she really started to come into her own in the last 10, 20 years, I would say, especially in the theater, and really gained a lot of respect and, you know, sort of not rehabilitated her image, but really, you know, showed herself a true Redgrave in every sense of the word as far as talent and ability and perseverance. And so, you know, she was very funny in Gods and Monsters, you know, the crazy housekeeper. And she really changed my opinion of her in the last 10, 15 years for the much the better. So it's wonderful, I think, that she got that validation and was wholly, even though she got nominated all those years ago for Georgie Girl, I feel like she became sort of, you know, she was doing like those diet ads and stuff for all those years, sort of the low rent Redgrave. And she really, really proved herself, I think, as an artist in the last 10, 20 years.
She actually said that in interviews, that there was her brother who was the brains, there was Vanessa who was the great actress, and, you know,
who was a genius.
Yeah, then there was this Lynn, you know, then there was Lynn.
Aww.
Well, now, Michael, Lynn Redgrave changed your opinion of her in the last 10 to 15 years of her life, but did what Roman Polanski pulled over the weekend change your opinion of him? He posted an article or a post on Bernard-Henri Lévy's website, which was, "I can remain silent no longer."
I don't know if he needs to change my mind so much as Karen's. That'll be the interesting thing. I doubt he,
nope.
I doubt he changed anyone's mind, though I love the fact that only a French film director would post his press release statement about his incarceration in Switzerland on the website of one of the new philosophers guiding, you know, lights, Bernard-Henri Lévy. But he makes it sound like this great political protest, like he's Nelson Mandela locked in prison rather than a serial child.
I have served my sentence!
Right, rather than a serial child molester. But he does repeat an impassioned statement, the facts that are fairly true and confirmed in Maria Zenovich's film, a friend of an acquaintance of Sperling and I, and it's in the public record. And he says a couple of things. Basically, he doesn't want pity. He just wants to be treated fairly like everyone else. He pled guilty for his crimes, which included having sex with a minor. He did serve time in a Chino, California prison, and that was supposed to constitute his penalty until the judge in the case changed his mind. And that's when he fled the U.S. He's quoted about Maria Zenovich's documentary film Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired by saying, quote, "It not only highlighted the fact that I left the U.S. because I've been treated unjustly, it also drew the ire of the Los Angeles authorities, who felt that they'd been attacked and decided to request my extradition from Switzerland, a country I have been visiting regularly for over 30 years without let or hindrance." And then comes his impassioned plea. "I can remain silent no longer because the request for my extradition addressed to the Swiss authorities is founded on a lie. I can remain silent no longer because for over 30 years, my lawyers have never ceased to insist I was betrayed. I can remain silent no longer." And again and again and again. The fascinating thing is this is how people reach out to the public now. They do it via Twitter. They do it via a philosopher's website. It's just the last thing they do is hold a press conference and let, you know, Barbara Walters be their intermediary.
Well, I mean, think about it. Would you want to put your statement or what you wanted to have reach the public into the hands of the media who has profited from reporting on this case for the last 30 some odd years? Or would you like to control it? And he decided he was going to control it. He knew that the media would find out about it, and they did.
Yeah, no, I don't hold that against him at all. I mean, I'm frankly surprised it took him so long. But Michael, you said that he, you know, copped to the fact that he had, what was it, unlawful sex with a minor or whatever was it you said. I don't think that's actually what he pled to. He pled to some lesser charge.
Statutory rape.
No, I don't even think it was that. It was a lesser charge than that. It was like...
It was unquestionably statutory rape because... She
I don't think
minor.
Rape
she
was
couldn't.
In there.
Yeah, statutory rape of a 13-year-old. Absolutely.
I think that's what he was accused of. I don't think that's what he actually pled to.
I don't know. We'll have to look that up. Or maybe you can write into dirt@showbizsandbox.com and let us know. A little plug for our email address.
Yeah. But you know what? Speaking of control, and we can go back to the Roman Polanski thing if you want to, but I wanted to talk about the Sandra Bullock People magazine article, not because I care that she's adopted a baby or anything, but what I thought was interesting was the way that she controlled that interview. Because I've got a friend who was like, that whole thing was so staged and I have no more respect for her. To me, it was brilliant. I mean, that's what you do when you are the publicist for Sandra Bullock. You give People magazine an exclusive. You give people a reason to not feel sorry for Sandra Bullock. And you let her control the entire interview. I had no problem with that.
By the way, Polanski pleaded to the lesser charge of engaging in unlawful intercourse with a minor, a charge which is synonymous under California law with statutory rape.
Okay, I stand corrected.
But all I saw was the picture on the cover of People. Why would anybody be surprised that she – did they think it was just the timing was off? Because clearly she had it in the works for a while to adopt a child.
Well, apparently the kid had been with them since January, and they wanted to keep it under wraps. And my friend was like, that's so mysterious. I was like, it's not mysterious. She had an Oscar campaign that she was running. I mean, it's kind of cynical, but
it would have been cynical if she'd announced it in January, actually.
Yeah,
well, especially because it was very much life imitating art. She adopted, you know, this African-American boy, and it was exactly what Blindside was about.
Right.
Stephen Colbert had the best line. He said, Sandra Bullock has adopted an African-American baby. NFL scouts, I would sign that kid now.
Right?
That's a good line, actually. You know, it pays to have a staff of writers.
People get kind of angry is too strong a word, but bent out of shape when people like Sandra Bullock or Roman Polanski are just controlling the way that they're going to be perceived in the media. I don't have a problem with that. I think that's smart.
Well, and the bar for doing so has been lowered thanks to the internet. In years past, you had to get the New York Times, or the Los Angeles Times, or whatever media, whether it's the New Yorker or People magazine, you had to get them to publish a story. It wasn't easy, unless you were a big star. These days, you can post whatever you want on the internet for zero cost. And at some point, if you are well-known enough, people will find it.
Yeah, and I don't think Roman Polanski was sort of trying to stick it to the media by releasing it. I think it just is the best way to get your statement out initially, unfiltered. And I think Sandra Bullock, clearly adopting the kid, she was probably planning to adopt him with Jesse. I wonder if there was any having to be last-minute changes as far as who was responsible for the adoption, because she probably
adopting as a single parent.
Yes, only her name is on the birth certificate.
She did.
Yes.
Yep. Interesting. Well, not wanting to have it get out during the Oscar campaign makes sense. That would have been seen as crass and tactless and cynical, and you know. But she just wanted to keep it under wraps. But eventually, you know, it's going to come out. You can't be around with a kid without somebody noticing. Hey, who's that little child that you're holding, Sandra? So you know, you've got to release it. So of course, do it through People. Let them, you know, present it in the proper way.
And what's interesting is that everybody blasted Gizmodo, a gadget blog, for paying $5,000 for the fourth generation iPhone, which they then posted online, this iPhone that was lost in a bar in the San Francisco Bay Area. But there is no doubt that this Sandra Bullock story for People was checkbook journalism. And, you know, does it really matter in this case? I'm sure she gave the money to charity.
She might have donated the money to charity. We don't know that she tried to profit off the child. Sometimes they want to have an exclusive place and present it well, and they do get money, but they donate it to charity or whatever. So I don't think she needed to make extra bucks off of this.
No. I'm not suggesting that. I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just saying,
coming at it from the other perspective.
From the People
magazine, actually paying for a story.
Because whatever money she did make, like Angelina Jolie.
Well, yes, but she didn't steal the child. If she obtained the child illegally, then it would be, you shouldn't pay her for it. Absolutely.
Good point. All right. Touche.
She didn't steal the child.
There's your title. Sandra Bullock steals a child. What do you think? Good title.
Let's not get sued.
Yeah.
Sandra Bullock didn't steal the child.
Okay.
Or it's not like she stole the child.
This is like the Sausage Factory podcast.
Yeah, Showbiz Sandbox, the sausage episode.
Yeah, but you're seeing how...
Hey, whoa, not me.
Well, wait a second. You're taking that in a completely different context.
So I guess the high school reunion wasn't completely successful.
No, it wasn't. I tried.
Well, that's a sure sign that we should move on to television. And it turns out, it's probably happening right now. If you're a big fan of Chuck, you're probably joining one of the SOS flash mobs. Turns out that all of these fans who are constantly trying to save Chuck from being canceled by NBC... decided that last year's finale and a footlong, which was a big Subway-based campaign to save the show, wasn't enough. This year they decided to to stage themed rallies in Chicago, Seattle, San Diego, and Philadelphia sometime today, Monday. And the idea was hatched by ChuckTV.net, which is a fan site for the show. And do you think that these kinds of campaigns actually work?
No.
Is that a hard no?
That would have been a soft no 2 years ago. Now it's a hard no.
Well, didn't it kind of work for Family Guy?
No, Family Guy came back because it did so well on DVD.
Yeah, no, okay. What you're thinking of is probably Jericho.
Okay. Well, what do you think, Michael?
Obviously, it's diminishing returns when they happened originally and were sort of unprecedented and it had never happened before, and it was harder for people to get together. They had a dramatic effect. You know, wow, my God, 80,000 people did something for a show. Now, as they're more common, of course, they have less pop each one, and it's so much easier for people to send in an email about a show. But it never hurts if you're a fan to write a personal letter to the studio and say, I love the show, please keep it on the air. Because Nielsen's don't always reflect the entire audience, especially for shows that reach college students or people online or things like that. So yeah, it can only help if you're a fan. And you know, it's gonna, when half the shows on TV have a campaign for them, yeah, it's not so exciting. But you know, it happens. It happens naturally sometimes. And you know, it can only help.
But well, I think that ultimately studios canceled the show for a reason. I mean, look at Jericho. You know, it was a very successful campaign, and they brought the show back, and they canceled it again.
Right.
It's like, there was a reason why we wanted to cancel this in the first place.
Yeah, it didn't have an audience.
It won't keep a show around that's not doing well. But if it's on the bubble and they're thinking about it, a passionate fan base can only help. You know, helps to buy the DVD set. It helps to send in an email. It helps to take part in an online campaign. You know, everything you do. But as always, when it's... whether it's a senator or a congressman or, you know, NBC, when you write a personal email, it means a lot more than just clicking a box on some generic, you know, Save Our Show website. You know, sending them a real email that you wrote yourself saying, I love the show, I watch it with my kids. That helps. That has a big effect.
Yeah, when it goes into the publicist's intern's email box and, you know, maybe he or she actually gets around reading it.
So cynical, Karen. I wonder if NBC isn't doing this to Chuck on a regular basis just to keep it in the news, just to make sure that, you know.
I'm sure that's a large part of it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, USA Today held a poll that it's their 13th annual Save Our Shows poll. In fact, 80,000 votes were cast in it, and they listed 16 shows and asked people to vote on which ones they really wanted to see stick around. And Chuck tied for second with CBS's Cold Case. In first place was Law & Order, which is trying to break a record with 21 consecutive seasons on the air.
I just don't understand. People, Law & Order is on all the time. All the time.
Well, I want it back because it's about to set the record for the longest running drama in TV history, beating out Gunsmoke. So that's why I wanted to see it come back.
Well, the show that voters least wanted off the air was Target, with only 15% opting to dump it.
What's Target? Do they mean human Target?
Hard Target?
I have no
human
idea.
Target, yeah. Must be Human Target.
I think that's a shortened reference to Human Target, which, you know, some shows in these polls, they become the second or third most desired plus the second or first most desired to dump. And I think Human Target was in that category, where 37% of people voted to bring it back, and also a number of people wanted to see it dump. So, you know.
Well, the least popular shows were CBS's late entry Miami Medical and CW's aging One Tree Hill.
Yeah, I don't think you can count Miami Medical. That's not really fair. It's had, like, what, two episodes? But, like, One Tree Hill, whoa, I can't believe it's still hanging on, frankly.
Well, right. What's interesting about the USA Today poll is they pinpointed that Law & Order was especially popular among the 40-plus crowd. And that, yes, and that is their target audience. So for advertisers, if you want to advertise to the 40-plus crowd, guess what? Advertise on Law & Order. And if you want to
Grandma loves it. Unfortunately, my grandma doesn't shop for anything anymore.
Well, if you want to advertise to 20 or 30 somethings, advertise on Chuck, because that's who was voting for that particular show. And One Tree Hill was really popular with nobody. Actually, no, it was popular with teens. I don't know who watches that show. I've never even
tweens.
Seen it.
I would guess tweens. I mean, I'm thinking 12, 13 year olds.
No, a little bit older than that, you know. It had teenage girls. It was Chad Michael Murray all the way. I interviewed him when the show was launched and, you know, hanging by a thread. And it ran for quite a number of years. So good for them. But it's definitely time to say goodbye.
But CMM isn't on it anymore.
Oh, I know. It's well past the time for it to say goodbye. When a show's set in high school and the kids have graduated college and have kids, please Just yeah, give it up.
Yeah, and they're going to, like, you know, One Tree Hill College.
It's now Four Tree Hill. They've got so many trees now. I mean, it's...
Well, I'll tell you, you know what NBC should do is just pick up all these shows, because apparently they are in desperate need of programming. As Jeff Gaspin told the New York Times when he was interviewed by them, I guess sometime last week, and the story ran in Sunday's paper. And he says, and these are all quotes that he gave the New York Times, "This is the first year in quite some time that we're being realistic. We're being realistic about how much we need to spend. We're being realistic about what our margin should be or what our amount of loss should be. We're being realistic about what it actually takes. You can only manage through cost cuts for a short period of time, and we've been doing it for 5 years." And I should say, Jeff Gaspin is the head of programming over at NBC.
Yeah, I mean, this is long overdue. NBC's been trying to do it on the cheap for years. They've been trying to have, you know, fewer pilots, fewer scripts, fewer episodes, you know, approved to go on the air. They've just been doing that. You know, you can't create a hot show. You have to do 10, 20, 30 shows to find the one or two that actually work. And they have so many holes in their schedule. I think last season they had like 10 pilots, and this year they're doing at least 20, I think. I mean, because you have to. You can't create chemistry and find, until you film it, you have no idea what you really have. And you can't do things, you know, on the cheap. You have to throw a lot of things at the wall to make it stick.
Yeah, I like that he went to Zucker and said, "We're going to have to pay."
You have to actually fund programming to find out shows.
Well, he says, "Our goal right now is to find those shows that are the tent poles of your schedule. I don't care where they come from. I don't care whether we own them or not. So we're hiring Courtney Love, not Courtney Love. So we're hiring Courtney Cox and getting the Friends gang back together."
Actually, if he hired Courtney Love, I'd watch that.
Yeah, okay.
He's not really hiring Courtney Cox. She's on the show, right?
Yeah, she's taken.
Yeah, she's taken. The best line came at the very end. He says, "I don't have to worry." He's talking about late night here. And he says, "I don't have to worry about Conan anymore. Whereas if he was on Fox, we'd all be, you know, what's it going to do? That's all over. The Conan story is gone for me." So what he's alluding to is the fact that, well, Conan went to TBS. So as long as he's not on broadcast, on a broadcast channel, then I don't have to worry about him.
Yeah, and totally dissed Conan. And yeah, Michael, he was an idiot. Like,
he's an idiot. I mean, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert is on 11:30 on Comedy Central and gets a million people. That doesn't help. That's why Letterman and Leno are, you know, lows compared to where they were 8-10 years ago. And you've got Conan on at 11 to 12. That is definitely a factor. And, you know, he's just trying to, you know, downplay and slam him. It's like you treated him like dirt. Now you're insulting him and cable television, which is nibbling away at your audience. It's just stupid on it. They have to worry about Adult Swim. They have to worry about Comedy Central. They have to worry about TBS. They got to worry about everybody.
Now, did any of you see the interview that Conan O'Brien gave to Steve Croft of 60 Minutes on CBS over the weekend on Sunday evening?
No, it's in my queue.
I was in knee deep in water.
Well, I wish you guys had seen it, because it was interesting. He was asked, "Did Jeff Zucker or any of these NBC people call you?" "No." "Has Jay Leno called you?" "No." And he doesn't expect to hear from him. And he looked really uncomfortable during the interview. It wasn't the jovial, funny Conan O'Brien, late night talk show host that we've all come to know and love. It was really kind of emotional, actually. Andy Wallenstein of the and I tried to get him on to talk about this. He wrote an interesting article in The Hollywood Reporter about why Conan should not have done 60 Minutes.
What did he say?
He said if there was one statement that encapsulated the awkward mishap that was O'Brien's post-contractual TV blackout coming out party, it was this rather transparent attempt to contradict a portrait he probably didn't intend to offer on national TV. And I guess he's talking about how he was asked, you know, "How are you?" And O'Brien responded, "It's crucial to me that anyone take away anything from this, it's that I'm fine." And, you know, he kind of said that he hopes that people still find him comedically absurd and ridiculous when he returns, but that he's doing okay. And then Wallenstein, in response to that, says, the O'Brien on display is clearly not, quote unquote, fine, but a deeply hurt individual licking his wounds for all to see. And that is exactly true. I have to say, that is spot on. Andrew Wallenstein, The Hollywood Reporter, that is spot on.
What I don't, forgetting what he said, because I must be the only person who doesn't know since I'm knee deep in water, but why did Conan O'Brien and his people choose to go on 60 Minutes? I mean, the people on 60 Minutes are 60 years old. They're not his audience. It's aging dinosaurs, CBS. Why wouldn't he go on, you know, Jon Stewart or something much cooler than that? It'd be such a much better audience and a much better way to stay cool and get his message out to the people who he actually wants to reach. I mean, why 60 Minutes? It just looks so tired.
Well, it's funny that you mention that, because that's exactly what Wallenstein says here. He says, the worst part of it all was that O'Brien picked the wrong show for making his return to TV. Watching O'Brien describe his tonight exit with the gravity of a life-or-death ordeal seemed all the more bizarre in context of 60 Minutes, which so often delivers stories of the struggle, of true struggle and pain.
My guess is that he opted to focus on his weaknesses and not his strengths. So he went on 60 Minutes to get the older people who are probably wouldn't have known to watch his show. They probably thought they were reaching out and gathering a new demo, when in reality, of course, we know that's not going to happen.
And I mean, and you don't even want, I mean, it's wrong. They should want them, but advertisers don't even want them. And TBS doesn't want them. They would rather not even have them on your audience. They'd much rather have you be like Jon Stewart and reach a pure 800,000 18 to 34 demo or whatever it is. You know, so it just seems, and Steve Croft, you know, it just seems such a tired, old school way of getting your word out. Why give your first interview to them? It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, you'd think you'd do it to CNN, somebody who's on broadcast cable. The one thing that Conan, broadcast cable, that makes no sense, cable. The one thing Conan did point out is that, you know, anybody that thinks that being on a cable network is not as good as being on broadcast has not been paying attention to television over the last 5 to 10 years, and I'd have to agree with that.
Yeah.
But let's see whether, so, but now, so Michael, you're saying that this was not a big deal at all for him to be giving this interview.
To give it to the 60 Minutes is a big whoop. The interview, it's his first time he talks, it's a big deal.
That was my poor segue into our popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. And, well, our first story is about Courtney Love. She has come clean. Her band Hole has an acclaimed new album out in stores, and Love was characteristically blunt about sleeping with Gavin Rossdale, the lead singer of Bush, while he was dating Gwen Stefani, doing tons of cocaine, and, you know, all the things that go along with that. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. I don't care about Courtney Love's sex life. I'm sure it's a huge deal to Gwen Stefani, but I could care less.
Michael?
It's a big deal about the music. I'm glad she has a new album. I don't care about what she says to people, but she's really talented. And she's been in the shadow of her husband, obviously, for so long. And I'm excited to hear the new album. It hasn't come to me yet because I've been traveling, but she's
I wouldn't say she's been in Kurt Cobain's shadow over the past 5 years.
Yeah, she's been in her own shadow for the past 5 years.
Fair enough.
When I worked at CAA, she was one of the clients that I worked with, and she would call me at all hours of the night and day. And I probably shouldn't even be saying this, but
like at home?
That's awesome.
Yes. And on my cell phone, I was just like, oh my God, I got a cell phone, and it was just weird. And she would ramble, and I didn't understand why she was calling all the time. Long story short, I'm reading this story for today's show, and it talks about this 2004 David Letterman appearance she made, in which she was falling down stoned. I mean, she was high as a kite on, I guess, cocaine. I can't believe they aired that. It was embarrassing, I think, for everybody. He just didn't know what to do.
They pay extra for that sort of thing. Are you kidding me? The train wreck guest appearance is a late night mainstay. Farrah Fawcett, Madonna, Courtney Love, they don't have to be on drugs, but just that sort of train wreck guest appearance is gold.
Well, you kind of wonder how an educated guy like Edward Norton wound up dating her for so long.
I have an answer, but it's not for a family podcast.
Oh, really? What is it? Just kidding. Let's move on to our second story of the week. The Twilight finale has a director. Even before Twilight Saga Eclipse is released June 30th, the final has a director. Bill Condon follows in the footsteps of Catherine Hardwicke, Chris Weitz, and David Slade in helming an episode of the saga. Michael, as a member of Team Jacob, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I like Bill Condon, but I don't know why they think stunt casting in directors is going to help a franchise. If you found a good one, you should stick with them. But I don't think Bill Condon can turn a bad book into a good movie.
Well, you know, for a while, Gus Van Zandt and Sofia Coppola were rumored to be, you know, potential candidates for this film. In the end, it's Bill Condon, the director of Gods and Monsters and Dreamgirls. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You know, I think it would have been a big deal if had it been Gus Van Sant or Sofia Coppola, but the fact that it's Bill Condon, whoa, I could care less. And my guess is that he's going to make a complete mess of it. But what it's a huge deal here is that you're, Michael, you're on Team Jacob?
I'm all about the werewolves, absolutely.
I mean, don't get me wrong. The werewolves are a hell of a lot cooler than than the vampires, but Team Jake, Taylor Lautner, really?
just for a one-night stand.
Wow.
Okay. Well, that's different.
You know, taking this...
As long as he doesn't call you.
No. Yeah, I don't want that.
Hey, we're a family show, remember?
Oh, sorry about that. Just to hang out with. All right.
Okay.
Well, let's move on to our next story. M. Night Shyamalan's summer blockbuster, The Last Airbender, which is due out July 2nd in 2D and 3D, as we discussed last week. It's being criticized for casting white people in central roles of Aang, the last airbender, and his friends Sokka, Katara, names I can't pronounce. But lots of other roles are played by non-whites, exclaims the director. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You know, I really can't decide yet. I think seeing as this has not been a huge story yet, despite the fact that this was in the LA Times, I'm going to say for right now, it's a big whoop. But watch for it to become a much bigger deal.
Michael?
I think it's a big deal historically. I mean, you know, come on. It's, you know, M. Night Shyamalan's like, oh, there's lots of people of color in the movie. Yeah, but the three leads are little white kids, and they're all playing characters that are clearly meant to be Asian in the pretty cool, series, the TV series. It's a cool little series, but I'm looking forward to the movie. But yeah, it's an old story. It's never going to change, but it's a bummer. At least the lead kid could have been Asian.
Yeah, this is a film based on the Nickelodeon television series, which is animated. That was,
and like, it's a lot of fun.
Poorly constructed sentence. Moving on to another train wreck. I mean, Lindsay Lohan, who is dumped.
Careful, she'll sue you.
Yeah, that's true. She's been dumped from a starring role. The director of The Other Side very publicly said he had to fire Lohan from the role she'd been cast in because financial people considered her unbankable. He was speaking out because rumors had spread that the entire cast had bolted, but insists Woody Harrelson, Angelica Houston, and Giovanni Ribisi are still on board. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop overall. She's had a lot of hit films, but it's just another bad week. And it's kind of tacky on the director's part, too. I guess he had to address online rumors, but it just seems tacky to have to, like, throw that out there like that.
Karen?
You know, the biggest deal here is that it's a big whoop, and that's how much of a train wreck her life has become.
Wow.
Enough? But she'll come back. She'll come back because she's talented.
Oh, yeah, she's very talented. She'll come back.
Well, our next story is about Disney Theatrical, which has registered domain names for a slew of Disney properties that may hit Broadway. Aladdin, Pirates of the Caribbean, Shakespeare in Love, Father of the Bride, Freaky Friday, Nightmare Before Christmas, etc. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, right now it's a big whoop, but... you know, again, it's another story that look for it to become a big deal. Although, personally, I don't really care.
Michael?
It's a big deal. Why the heck weren't these domain names registered before? These are 10, 20-year-old properties sometimes. Somebody should be fired.
Well, actually, what was registered was like, you know, Aladdin on Broadway or Pirates of the Caribbean on Broadway.
Right, exactly. They should be going through the catalog. Herbie the Love Bug on Broadway. They should be registering domain names for every damn property they own.
Well, since domain names cost...
Not like they don't have the money to buy them if they need them.
Well, since domain names cost so much money, I think they're, what, like $6? They don't want to do it for every single film.
Like 10 bucks for a year.
I mean,
yeah.
The proposal on Broadway, the proposal, the musical, I mean, they don't need that, do they?
I don't know. I'd see them.
Aladdin, Pirates of the Caribbean, Nightmare Before Christmas, which is already a musical.
Hold on. I'd like to continue the podcast, but I'm...
Go, Daddy. Okay, sorry.
Well, moving on to Batman 3. It's finally gotten a release date. The third Batman pairing of director Christopher Nolan and actor Christian Bale, who plays the lead character, for those of you who have never seen one. It is coming out July 20th, 2012. I love the fact that they have a release date before they have a finished script. Nolan is still in post on his film Inception, which nobody knows a thing about. There's no script, no title, and they're still working out the broad storyline points. Michael, the boy wonder... Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, thank you for asking. It is a big deal because I feel like they're rushing the franchise again. You know, they announced a release date before they even have this, even a vague storyline idea. It's a big mistake.
Yeah, but this happens all the time. This is not like...
But it's stupid all the time.
Well, there's no question there, but, you know, the movie business is a business. And, you know, you can't say, well, you know, we really, you know, appreciate your artistic integrity and, you know, take 10 years to make Iron Man. Doesn't work that way.
Yeah, but this is 2 years away. This is awfully close again. 2 years is, you know, 3 years away. I would say, okay, 3 years is enough time. But 2 years is rushed with post. Post is like a year on these movies. So you're talking about, all right, you got to get a script done in 9 months. So you can lock in all the roles and cast them and get them, you know, locked into film next summer and then do post for 9 months and blah, blah, blah. Maybe it's going to be 3D. If this is a really, really tight schedule, it's not a good idea. Why mess around with a $1 billion franchise?
I agree with that. And of course, you know, 2012, you have the Avengers, Battleship, the Star Trek sequel, possibly a rebooted Spider-Man all coming out at the same time.
But it almost doesn't matter if it's good or not. I mean, it's going to make a ton of money. But true. It doesn't really matter how great it is.
That is very, very true. Well, before we move into Inside Baseball, we have some reader email, which we promised you at the head of the show, just after we talked about the really important news of the week. 20-year high school reunion and flash floods in Nashville. And Michael, why don't you take it away?
Great. I haven't seen this yet. This is from Priti Ramji, the CEO of Stratagem North, based in Toronto. And he wrote, after episode 50, you've got me curious about the movie Kick-Ass.
It's a she.
She, thank you very much. I don't know how you know that. You're psychic. Hello, Ms. Ramji. Thanks for writing in. It says, after episode 50, you've got me curious about Kick-Ass, and I brace myself for the unexpected. And interestingly enough, you mentioned it did well, yet it was considered a failure because it didn't reach its expected numbers. In my opinion, if a film is profitable, regardless of the numbers it reaches, it is still a success. Well, you're absolutely right and spoken like a true businesswoman. She goes on to say, I would have loved to have been at the Coachella Festival to see some great artists. Jay-Z, Muse, Blur, Tom York, Katy Perry. It's never easy to organize mass crowds or control drugs at these venues, but it is a part of the festival energy. I'm not sure if she means control drugs in the sense of make sure people don't do them or make sure they're of high quality. venues like these launch careers, so whose name are we going to hear about as a result of the festival? I'll stay tuned to your podcast to find out. Great segment. Thanks. Well, thank you very much for writing. And I guess Sperling would be the best one to tell us. Is there any smaller artist that really broke out at Coachella this year that you've seen gaining momentum from their appearance?
I liked Matt and Kim. I thought they did a great job. Unfortunately, nobody's talking about them. And LaRue did a phenomenal job. And there was a lot of buzz about her. So
cool.
I would say keep an eye on both of those. Matt and Kim has kind of already made it a little bit. So speaking of music, our Inside Baseball topic this week is about music. And of course, Inside Baseball is our segment each week where we discuss only the news stories that Hollywood might care about. This week, and thank you, Karen, for pointing it out, Apple is shutting down La La. This is a subscription iTunes soon behind.
This is a huge, huge deal.
I agree.
Talk to me.
You know I hate having to actually explain my stories. Okay, well, La La is like Rhapsody and Spotify. That have they're subscription based. So instead of paying, you know, 99 cents for a song, you pay X number of dollars a month and you have access to all the songs that you want and you can play them whenever you want, but you don't actually own them. When Apple actually bought La La, that was a big deal. People started to kind of wonder whether it meant that they were gonna turn into a subscription based service, whether iTunes would, and now it looks like that might very well be the case.
Yeah, I mean, they have this big data center in North Carolina that they've purchased, and people are speculating that it's for iTunes.com, they're going to launch a subscription service of some kind, and rumors...
What do we think they're going to launch?
It'll be iTunes.com, it'll be web-based, and you'll pay $20 a month, and you won't own any of your songs, but you'll have access to all the songs in the iTunes library for as long as you are a subscriber to iTunes.com.
Right, and there is some speculation amongst industry insiders that it will launch what they consider to be an underwhelming digital locker-type service to house those tracks that you've already purchased in the cloud before they then turn it into a subscription model.
And the purpose of the cloud is just so that, A, you don't lose it, and B, like if you're a phone, you don't have to store all your music. You can access it anyway, right? Is that
right?
The idea?
Or if you're like me going from a PC to a Mac, you don't have to figure out how to, you know, or any computer to any computer. You don't have to figure out, well, how do I move over my iTunes? Because it all lives in the cloud.
Right. It's all there all the time. And as mobile bandwidth becomes pretty much...
But the big thing is the subscription service, the idea that you just pay a flat monthly fee like you do for cable, and you get to listen to all the music in the world, basically. Everything on iTunes, which is a ton, hundreds of millions of tracks.
Right.
Yes.
Right. But you don't own them.
Right.
Right. You're just renting the ability to access them.
Exactly.
Right. What I liked about Lala was the fact that you could listen to a song once for free. And then you had to pay like 10 cents to own just the web version, meaning that you could only listen to it online, or you could pay, you know, 99 cents and own the web version and, you know, be able to download it. So the fact that this is going away, I guess May 31st is the last date that they will...
Have you been to lala.com?
No, I haven't.
There's like a big sign that's like, we are shutting down and... You know, it's, you know, if you have an account, you can still access it here, but nobody new can come.
Well, this is a big deal. Here's a couple of facts. First of all, iTunes is the number one record store in the world right now. They have 25% of the entire world market, I believe.
Right.
They're like Kleenex. I mean, they are online music.
Well, yeah. And digital.
Well, they're music, not online. They're music, period. You know, people... They of all music sales, they have like 25% in the U.S.
Well, this paid content story pointed out that sales from digital tracks have actually begun to flatline and grew just 1.1% in 2009. So the music industry is really looking for the next big revenue earner, and they're hoping that subscriptions are it. I don't know that it will be. It might be for the big labels, but I don't know if it's going to be a big profit center for artists.
Or for consumers. I mean... Well, you know, profit center for artists, but I don't know if it's a good thing for consumers. I want to own my music.
So do I. I like the idea and vaguely. I suppose the idea would be like on Kindle, if you could pay $10 a month and just read any book in the world that you wanted that's on Kindle. And that makes sense in a way. It's like your own library, but you don't own it. You can get to go
and
with someone's
life. And I rent Netflix, so I don't know why I feel differently about my music, but I do.
Yeah. You know, it's
and of course, it's one more monthly bill.
Right. We talked about that last week, that, you know, between Netflix and Hulu and it.
And New York Times and, you know. It's like...
Well, these businesses are finally saying, hey, you know what? It's nice that we gave it away for free for so long, but we can't survive that way. We have to start charging.
Right. And looking at some of the things, like worldwide, I think music is like $20 billion, $23 billion. In the U.S., it's dropped from like... 14.6 billion in 99 down to 9 billion in the last few years. It might even be lower than that this year. On the other hand, so it's a shrinking pie. And on the other hand, actual individual sales of whether it's a digital single or whatever are higher than ever. The amount of total sales purchases is 1.5 billion. Albums, singles, digital tracks, music videos. People are buying more pieces than ever before in history. And you know, it's up. But they're just buying a single. I mean, you had last year, I think you had four singles that went quadruple platinum, which is pretty unheard of. We've really gone back to the 60s and early 50s. We had the Black Eyed Peas, Lady Gaga, Flo Rida. I mean, we are in the era of the single and the tour. It's just like the 60s again. You know, album sales are sort of this afterthought. And artists make their money on tour and selling a ton of singles. And it's really in turmoil. But there's no question that music sales have gone down dollar-wise. So there's a lot less money to go around. I don't know if a subscription is going to be the cure, but it worked in Europe.
You know, I'm actually really surprised to see that Rhapsody has 675,000 subscribers and that Spotify has 320,000. I mean, the 320,000 I can believe, but Rhapsody having 675,000, that seems like a lot. And then you have coming down the pike, Mog.com, something I've never heard of, and Radio.com, spelled without an A because that's...
Taken.
Yeah, yes.
But that's like a million people. Say a million people at $10 a month. So that's 10 million a month. That's $120 million a year. You're talking about a $9 billion industry.
Right. Well, you're right.
That's not making up for a lot.
Well, and I think this is my conspiracy theory behind this move by Apple. A ways back, I think it was in January. I don't know when it was, but Google announced this music search service that would point to tracks that were on Lala. So if you search for music, and I think one out of every three searches on Google is about music, it would point you to the song on Lala. Well, as you know, Google has the Android operating system for mobile phones, and Apple has this little tiny product called the iPhone and the iPad, and they're in like this heated battle going back and forth.
Google has their digital book sale library, and they want to sell it to everyone. And they're going to launch that in June and make those available to work on any platform, while Apple has their own iPad and their proprietary version, which they want to only work on their own products. So they're competing with Google and Kindle in that area.
Right. And so the way they're handling this is they are just going to shut La La down, and that way they don't have to break a contract with Google, but Google doesn't have that service to rely on anymore in their search results.
Huh. Plus, it's another way of selling music, and they should do it. Whether it interests us, if they can make $100 million a year on it, then they should sure as hell offer it. Why not?
I'll pass that suggestion along to them. What do you think?
Yeah, tell them I say hi.
I'll send an email on my iPad.
Yes, and if you do, you can send it to dirt@showbizsandbox.com, which is the email address to reach us, where we can read your email next time, and we promise that we will get your gender correct next time. You can also call us. 888-
Thank you for writing, Ramji.
Pretty, Ramji.
Pretty.
You can also send us a voicemail by calling 888-567-SAND or 888-567-7263. Links to any of the stories we've discussed in today's episode can be found in our show notes, which can be located on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, because we are just really, social. And I should say that we've gotten a couple of emails asking us about the number of posts that we are putting up on Twitter. We are working on that. So,
oh my God, it's 8 million tweets.
Yes, we're working on it. We're working on it. So it will slow down a bit, or I should say a lot. In any case, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. They can be found at whoismgmt.com, which is their website. They're also on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT. Talk about a company that missed the boat on this whole digital lockering music subscription service. MySpace is definitely that company. Michael and Karen, you can be found online too. Karen, you're at karenwoodwardonline.com. And your Twitter account is Karen_Woodward. And Michael, your username on Twitter is Michael Giltz. That's very complicated to remember, so you'll have to spell his entire name out, much like you would to reach him at his website, michaelgiltz.com. To read any of my work, you'll have to remember how to spell celluloid. You can look for it on celluloidjunkie.com, or I'm on Twitter, at Sperling is the username to look up. Michael, I will see you in Cannes in 1 week.
I can't wait. And until then, I'm not waving, but drowning.
Well,
aww, take care.
Well, be safe, stay dry, and until next week, play nice.